5 years. You get old a lot faster than you think you will, no matter how old you are now, and most of what you could do with your family, with marriage, children, and so forth, is from 20-something to about 35. How many good 5-year chances do you therefore have? 3? 4 if you are fortunate? This means that your options decrease as you wait, rather than increase. If you are a widower or a widow and you must hit the dating scene when you were 40 or 50, so be it. You've been struck by tragedy, and that is life. But I have watched friends do it, and it is not a fate I would casually wish on anyone I loved. Let us continue to be reasonable about this. All 16 to 18-year-olds have much in common. They are unformed. They are malleable. That is not an insult. It is just a fact. It is also why they can go off to college and make a lifelong friend, no cynicism whatsoever intended, from a roommate within a single semester. By the time you are in your mid-40s, however, if you have lived at all, you have become somewhat of a singular and unique person. I have known people I met at that time of my life for a decade or more, whom I still seem to consider new acquaintances. That is a pure function of the complexity of increasing age, and that is mere friendship, not love. Not a joint life, and perhaps even the bringing together of two disparate families. And so you have your marriage and your children, and that is working out well, because you are stubborn and sufficiently terrified of the hell that awaits anyone who fails to negotiate for peace and make the sacrifices necessary to establish it. You are undoubtedly more prepared now for your career, or more likely, your job. That is another major achievement you might manage, with good fortune and an undaunted spirit, in the brief flash of your existence. You have learned how to establish productive harmony in the close confines of your most intimate and private relationships, and some of that wisdom spills over into your workplace. You are a mentor for younger people, a helpful peer and reliable subordinate, and instead of the hash you could so easily make of the place you inhabit, you improve it. And if everyone did that, the world would be a much less tragic and unhappy place. Maybe it would even be a self-evidently good place. And perhaps you learn how to make good use of your time away from family and work, your leisure, and you make that meaningful and productive. And that is perhaps the final of life's fundamental achievements, and one, like the others, that can grow. Perhaps you get better and better at such things so that you can work on solving more and more difficult problems and become a credit in your own way to the spirit of humanity itself. And that is life. Back to marriage. How do you plan and diligently maintain the romance in your relationship? Well, you have to decide. Do you want some romance in your life or not? If you really think about it, without resentment, without the joy of depriving your partner, now alienated, of the pleasure that might come with such an attempt, the answer is generally yes. Sexual romance. The adventure, pleasure, intimacy, and excitement people fantasize about experiencing when they are feeling in need of a touch of the divine. You want that. The joys of life are rare and precious, and you do not want to forsake them without due cause. How are you going to accomplish that? With luck, it will happen between you and someone you like. With better luck and sufficient commitment, it will happen between you and someone you love. Little about this is easy. If you set up a household with someone, you're going to have to do an awful lot of negotiation to keep both like and love alive. The domestic economy. Here are some practical considerations. They may seem far from the topic of romance. The discussion is necessary, however, because we transcended or lost our traditional roles and have not formulated replacements for them. Before that happened, perhaps before the invention of the birth control pill, which was a biological revolution, men did male things, whatever they were, and women did female things, whatever they were. Traditional roles are far more helpful than modern people, who vastly overestimate their tolerance for freedom and choice, tend to realize. In a less rapidly mutable society, everyone has some sense of their respective duties. That does not eliminate the tension. Nothing eliminates the tension, but at least there is a template. If there is no template for what either of you should be doing when you live together with someone, then you are required to argue about it, or negotiate about it if you're good at that, which you are probably not. Few people are. If you're going to set up a household in peace with someone you love and hopefully like and wish to continue loving and liking, you are going to have to determine in some manner who is going to do what. That is the replacement for roles. Who makes the bed? When should it be made? At what level of perfection does the bed have to be made to be mutually acceptable? And if this is not handled well, the conversation becomes counterproductive rapidly. I made the bed. Well, you did not do a very good job. Nothing's ever good enough for you. If you do not think I did a good enough job making the bed, maybe I'll just stop and you can make it yourself. Well, maybe you should raise your standards a bit, and maybe not just about the bed. It is going to take days to sort that out, if it ever does get sorted out, and that is just the bed. That is just the first 10 minutes of the morning. So maybe it remains unmade or made badly and bitterly for the next 60 years. There is that time span again. And there are many more domestic issues to address than just the bed. But if that is not sorted out, then it is a problem every morning of every day and every day of every week and month and year, and everyone is angry, at least under the surface, as soon as they awaken or every time they enter the bedroom, and other things begin to fall out of order. There is nothing good about that. Whose career is going to take priority? When? And why? How will the children be educated and disciplined? And by whom? Who does the cleaning? Who sets the table, takes out the garbage, cleans up the bathroom? How are the bank accounts set up and managed? Who shops for groceries, clothes, furniture? Who pays for what? Who adopts responsibility for the taxes? Etc., etc., etc. 200 things, perhaps, to run a household properly. As complex a problem as running a business, with the additional difficulty of trying to manage it with a family member, much of it repeated daily. Your life is, after all, mostly composed of what is repeated routinely. You either negotiate responsibility for every single one of these duties, or you play push and pull forever while you battle it out non-verbally with stubbornness, silence, and half-hearted attempts at cooperation. That is not going to do your romantic situation any good. It is a vital necessity, in consequence, to place the domestic part of the household economy on firm ground. It is an incredibly difficult set of problems to solve, because it means you must consciously sort the hierarchy of responsibilities between the partners in the household. You are required to negotiate every damned and apparently trivial detail. But the apparent triviality is a delusion. Who prepares the meals? When do they prepare the meals? What is that worth in terms of trade-off for other tasks? How do you thank someone for conducting themselves properly in the kitchen? Who loads the dishwasher? Who does the dishes? How fast do the dishes have to be cleared off the table after you eat? Which dishes are going to be used? What are we going to eat? What role are the kids going to play? Do we sit down together? Do we have regular meal times? Each of these questions can become a bloody war. One person thinks one thing, and the other person thinks another thing, and who knows who's right? So, you have to struggle with it, and you have to come to a consensus. Doing so is difficult. Maybe it means hundreds of fights. It certainly means dozens. But they can be fights with a purpose. And that purpose is to fight it out until a solution arises so that fights about that issue are no longer necessary. That makes peace the goal, and it cannot be established except through negotiation, and that requires a commitment strong enough to withstand serious and deep conflict. The next thing you have to do, I know this from both my clinical and marital experience, 30 years of each, is actually talk to your partner for about 90 minutes a week. Purely about practical and personal matters. What is happening to you at work? What is going on, as far as you are concerned, with the kids? What needs to be done around the house? What do we have to do to keep the wolf from the door next week? Is there anything bothering you that we could address? Just pure practical communication. Partly because you have a story, your partner has a story, and you have a joint story. To know your story, you must tell it, and for your partner to know it, he or she must hear it. It is necessary for that communication to happen on an ongoing basis. It does not have to be 90 minutes all at once. Maybe it can be 15 minutes a day. But you keep those lines of pragmatic communication open so you know where the other person is and vice versa. If you dip below 90 minutes a week, you generate a backlog and your mutual story begins to unwind. At some point, that backlog is so large that you do not know who you are yourself, and you certainly do not know who your partner is, and you become mutually alienated. Your relationship loses its coherence. That is a bad situation. When I am helping someone straighten out their marriage, let us say, we do very mundane things. I am not interested in vacations, special occasions, or anything that happens that is out of the ordinary. It is not that those things are unimportant, but they are not vital in the same sense that daily routines are vital. It is the latter that must be set right. I want to know what interrelationships constitute the bulk of your typical day. You wake up together, perhaps. You eat together. You do such things every day. Maybe waking up, preparing for the day, and eating make up 5 hours a day. That is a third of your waking time, therefore a third of your life. It is 35 hours every 7 days, a whole work week, an entire career. Get it right. Ask yourself and each other, how do we want these times to be structured? How can we make the morning awakening pleasant? Can we attend to each other politely and with interest and perhaps without electronic distractions while we eat? Could we make our meals delicious and the atmosphere welcoming? Consider coming home in the evening. Let us say that routine takes 10 minutes. So that is another hour plus per week, 50 hours a year, 1.5 work weeks. You spend 1.5 work weeks a year being greeted as you come in the door. It is a sizable fraction of your existence. Does somebody meet you at the door and indicate a certain degree of happiness to see you? Or are you met with a litany of complaints? Are you ignored, alternatively, because everyone is using their smartphones? How would you like to organize that so you do not dread the moment you arrive at home? There are things you do together that are mundane things. Those things you do every day, but they are your whole life. You get those things right, and you have established yourself much more effectively than you might realize. If you can successfully fight the war that establishes harmony in the domestic economy, you have both won a major victory. And then you can concentrate on what might happen during a romantic vacation to a boutique hotel, or your parents' cottage, or an all-inclusive resort, or an adventure holiday. Or just during that twice-weekly date we discussed earlier that you were both so reluctant to attempt. Start by getting these things straight and see what happens. Then you will have peaceful mealtimes, for example, and you will not die of frustration or high blood pressure. You will have to fight for such an accomplishment. What matters, however, is not whether you fight because you have to fight, but whether you make peace as a consequence. To make peace is to manage a negotiated solution, and you want and need to come to a negotiated solution about every responsibility and opportunity you share as a couple, and about every obstacle you encounter. At least then, you will have someone to talk things through with when your life gets complex, as it inevitably will, and you have the advantage of two heads, even though they will not see eye to eye. What all this means is that the problems of knowing what you want and discussing it with your partner must be solved before the romance in your relationship can be maintained. Other people keep you sane. That is partly why it is a good idea to get married. Why? Well, you are half insane, and so is your spouse. Well, maybe not half, but plenty. Hopefully, however, it is not generally the same half. Now and then you meet couples who have the same weakness, and they compound that failing in each other. Maybe they are both too fond of wine, for example, and they drift together toward alcoholism. What you might want to avoid such a fate is that one person in the couple is fond of alcohol, but not both. This will cause a certain amount of short-term conflict in situations where drinking is occurring or likely to occur, but the long-term consequences, avoiding either of you becoming an alcoholic, are likely to be beneficial. The one who does not drink will have a drink or two on a social occasion just to avoid being too rigid and horrible, and the one who likes to drink will get what is hopefully a salutary reprimand if he or she does not exercise proper control. It is a fortunate happenstance, generally speaking, that your idiosyncrasies are likely to be somewhat randomly distributed, and that if you unite with someone else, you are likely to find some strength where you are weak, and vice versa. When you unite the two of you to recreate that original divine being, that is the symbolic idea, then you have a chance of producing one reasonable, sane being. That is good for you both, even better for your children, who now have a fighting chance of adapting to what constitutes generally sane behavior, and it is good for friendship and the broader world, too. A lot of that movement toward functional unity is a consequence of dialogue and communication. If you are old enough, you know that people are badly broken. When you are young and not very experienced, you are likely to make two assumptions in a rather unquestioning and implicit manner that are simply not true. The first is that there is someone out there who is perfect. You are likely even to encounter this hypothetically perfect person whom you view through your delusion and to fall desperately and foolishly in love with them. Foolishly, because you are in love with your projection of perfection rather than the person, which is very confusing to the target of your affection. The second assumption is that there is someone out there who is perfect for you. From these assumptions, you are deriving at least three errors, which is quite an accomplishment given that you have made only two assumptions. To begin with, there is not anyone out there who is perfect. There are just people out there who are damaged, quite severely, although not always irreparably, and with a fair bit of individual idiosyncrasy. Apart from that, if there was someone out there who was perfect, they would take one look at you and run away screaming. Unless you are deceiving someone, why would you end up with anyone better than you? You should be truly terrified if you have been accepted as a date. A sensible person would think of their new potential romantic partner, "Oh my God, you are either blind, desperate, or as damaged as me." That is a horrifying idea, signing up with someone who is at least as much trouble as you. It is by no means as bad as being alone with yourself, but it is still out of the frying pan and into the fire, although at least the fire might transform you. Thus, you get married if you have any courage, if you have any long-term vision and ability to vow and adopt responsibility, if you have any maturity, and you start to transform the two of you into one reasonable person. And it is even the case that participating in such a dubious process makes the two of you into one reasonable person with the possibility of some growth. So, you talk about everything, no matter how painful, and you make peace, and you thank Providence if you manage it, because strife is the default condition. Finally, romance. There was not much point in this chapter in talking about romance immediately. At least not about its maintenance. Romance is play, and play does not take place easily when problems of any sort arise. Play requires peace, and peace requires negotiation. And you are lucky even then if you get to play. The issue of marital romance, intimacy, and sex is a complex one, with a dragon lurking under every question. For example, what do you owe each other sexually if you are entangled in a marriage? The answer is not no sex. That is not the answer, because part of the contractual arrangement is to organize your romantic life in a mutually satisfactory manner. It is an implicit precondition for the stability of the marriage. It is probably not sex 15 times a day. And it is probably not sex begrudgingly once a year. It is somewhere between extremes, and that is where you must begin to negotiate. My observation has been that the typical adult couple, when they have a job, children, and the domestic economy we just discussed, and all that worry and responsibility and concern, might manage once or twice a week, or even three times a week, not likely, for a reasonable romantic interlude. That frequency, if handled well, seems to work out acceptably for both partners. I have observed that twice is better than once, but once is much better than zero. Zero is bad. If you go to zero, then one of you is tyrannizing the other, and the other is submitting. If you go to zero, then one of you is going to have an affair, physical, emotional, fantastical, or some combination of the three. I do not say that lightly. Something has to give, and there has to be a no there somewhere when the romance disappears and the frequency of sexual intimacy hits rock bottom. There has to be a strong indication that this is not good enough. I am not recommending the affair, but that is what you are setting yourself up for if your sex life vanishes. Maybe you want to take that pathway and facilitate the affair because you want to play the martyr. My wife left me to have an affair, and poor me. And why did she do such a thing? Well, perhaps our sex life was not all it could have been, and this is an answer that may require a fair bit of digging. What exactly do you mean by was not all it could have been? Well, we had not made love for 2 years, and she went and had an affair. That is not a shock. You should begin by assuming that your partner is a relatively normal human being and that there is a certain amount of sexual satisfaction that is a reasonable requirement, let us say twice a week or once a week under conditions of intense busyness. In the early days of marriage, it might be no problem to express romantic interest in your partner, but there is so much that must be done to live. Dating is a pain, even if you are single. I am perfectly aware that there is adventure there, too, but a lot of that occurs in movies and not on internet dating sites, in text exchanges, coffee shops, restaurants, and bars where the first awkward encounters occur. You really have to work at it, and you will if you are single because you are lonesome, starved for attention, and desperate for physical intimacy. Single people have far less sex on average than married people, although I suppose that a small percentage are making out like bandits. But I cannot see that even those successful in that manner are doing themselves any favors. So, as a single person, you will work at dating because you are lonesome and deprived, but it is no simple matter. You must make space in your life for it. You have to plan. You must use your imagination, spend money, find an acceptable dating partner, and, as they say, kiss a lot of frogs to find a prince, or to find a princess as well. People are often relieved when they get married because they do not have to make all that so often counterproductive effort anymore. But that does not at all mean that you are now off the hook, that you can just lay back in your worn white underwear and socks and assume that all the hypothetical pleasures of Hugh Hefner are going to automatically manifest themselves in your household. There is still plenty of effort required unless you want the romance to vanish. You have to talk about it. You have to have the difficult and embarrassing conversation. What is it going to be, dear? Tuesday and Thursday? Wednesday and Friday? Monday and Saturday? You think, oh God, that is so cut and dried. That is so mundane and planned. That is so scheduled, predictable, bourgeois, anti-romantic, and robotic. It is demeaning and constricting, and it just turns sex into a duty. Where is the fun? Where is the spontaneity, the light jazz, cocktails, and excitement of sudden, unexpected attraction? Where is the tuxedo and the little black dress? That is what you expect? Even unconsciously in your foolish fantasies? How often did you manage that when you were dating? Ever? And remember, we are adults talking here. You want 2 jobs, 2 careers, 2 incomes, 2 kids, a reasonable standard of living, and spontaneity? And you're not about to settle for anything less. Good luck with that. It is not going to happen, not in my clinical and personal experience, not without a lot of effort. What will happen is that the absolute necessities of life will inexorably start to take priority over the desirable necessities. Maybe there is a list of 10 things you will do in a day, and sex is number 11. It is not that you do not think sex is important, but you do not ever get past number 5 on the list of 10. You must make space and time, and, as far as I can tell, you have to do it consciously. You might think, what would it be like to spend some time with this person I was once romantically attracted to? You have to think that through. Maybe you only have 1.5 hours with your partner, or even 1 hour, because life is too hectic. It would not be too bad an idea to have a shower. A little lipstick, that could be good. Some perfume, some clothing that is attractive and erotic. Buy some lingerie for your wife, if you are a man, and wear it with some courage, if you are a woman. Maybe you, if you are a man, can find something to wear yourself that is reasonably sexy in a men's shop or a place that sells erotic clothing that is not too extreme and does not scream of poor taste and produce intense and counterproductive self-consciousness. And a compliment or two, when all that courage is manifested, is not such a bad idea. Maybe each time it happens, for a year. You are trying to build some confidence. Try some nice soft lighting, maybe some candles. And someone has to buy the candles and should be encouraged to do so, and the cynicism should be kept to an absolute minimum if you do not want to banish what is fragile out of existence altogether. Here is a rule. Do not ever punish your partner for doing something you want them to continue doing, particularly if it took some real courage, some real going above and beyond the call of duty to manage. How about trying to set up the whole situation in the romantic manner that you might imagine if you were imagining having an affair? Because that is the sort of thing that people imagine when they imagine an affair, if they have any imagination. Try having an affair with your wife or husband. Maybe the latter can set up the bedroom while the former is preparing in the bathroom. We already mentioned candles. How about some music? How about making sure that the room is clean and, God willing, aesthetically attractive? That might be a start. And maybe the two of you will not get old and fat, unhealthy and hypochondriacal as fast as possible, just to spite each other, which many couples certainly do. And then, maybe, you could both have what you need, and maybe even what you want. But you would have to admit your desires, and you would have to negotiate with your partner. What do you like? What does she like? And are you going to let each other know? Are you going to risk practicing badly? Are you going to learn some new tricks, even if you feel like a fool when you first try? None of this is easy. People will do things with or to each other that they will not talk about with each other, which is not helpful if they are married. It could be, maybe, if you were in a trading mood and approaching this with goodwill, that you could decide what you need and want and arrange exactly the right trade. You might ask yourself, look, how do I have to set this up so I am likely to continue being romantically interested in my wife or my husband for the next 60 years? So that I do not wander off and do something stupid, like so many people do. What is my minimal precondition for erotic satisfaction? You might try to convince yourself that it is not necessary, that you can put up with what you have, even if it is nothing. But you cannot. Not if you have any self-respect or sense. There is something that you are going to want and need. It is possible that, if you communicate openly what that something is, and at the same time leave yourself open to the same communication coming from your partner, that you both could get not only what you want from each other, but even more than you expect. Arrange some dates, and then practice making those dates and going on them until you are expert at it. Negotiate and practice that, too. Allow yourself to become aware of what you want and need and have the decency to let your partner in on the secret. After all, who else are you going to tell? Devote yourself to the higher ideal upon which an honest and courageous relationship is necessarily dependent, and do that with the seriousness that will keep your soul intact. Maintain your marital vows so that you are desperate enough to negotiate honestly. Do not let your partner brush you off with protestations of ignorance or refusal to communicate. Do not be naive, and do not expect the beauty of love to maintain itself without all-out effort on your part. Distribute the requirements of your household in a manner you both find acceptable, and do not tyrannize or subject yourself to slavery. Decide what you need to keep yourself satisfied both in bed and out of it. And maybe, just maybe, you will maintain the love of your life, and you will have a friend and confidant, and this cold rock we live on at the far end of the cosmos will be a little warmer and more comforting than it would be otherwise. And you are going to need that, because rough times are always on their way, and you better have something to set against them, or despair will visit and will not depart. Plan and work diligently to maintain the romance in your relationship. Rule 11. Do not allow yourself to become resentful, deceitful, or arrogant. The story is the thing. You have your reasons for being resentful, deceitful, and arrogant. You face or will face terrible, chaotic forces, and you will sometimes be outmatched. Anxiety, doubt, shame, pain, and illness, the agony of conscience, the soul-shattering pit of grief, dashed dreams and disappointment, the reality of betrayal, subjection to the tyranny of social being, and the ignominy of aging unto death. How could you not degenerate and rage and sin and come to hate even hope itself? I want you to know how you might resist that decline, that degeneration into evil. To do so, to understand your own personality and its temptation by darkness, you need to know what you are up against. You need to understand your motivations for evil. And the triad of resentment, deceit, and arrogance is as good a decomposition of what constitutes evil as I have been able to formulate. Is it possible to understand the world in a manner that provides protection against the temptation to traverse that lowest of roads? It is an axiom of human wisdom that clearer formulation and deeper comprehension of a problem is salutary. We will begin just that attempt with a conceptual shift, one that is difficult and perplexing for the committed materialists we moderns are. First, a question. What is the world made of? To answer this, we will need to consider reality, the world, as it is fully experienced by someone alive and capable of consciousness, with all the richness of subjective being left intact, dreams, sensory experiences, feelings, drives, and fantasies. This is the world that manifests itself to, or better, that you meet head-on with, your unique individual consciousness. Consider the act of awakening in the morning. If you were asked what you perceive at that moment, you might well mention the same concrete objects that anyone else might see if they woke up in bed beside you. You might describe all that you have gathered around you in your bedroom, the desk, the chairs, the clothes, messy or neatly arrayed, depending on your temperament and preference, and perhaps your condition last night. You are likely to answer in this very objective, realistic manner, claiming essentially to see the furniture of the stage. There is, of course, some truth to your answer, although you may pay less attention to the familiar things around you than you think. Why waste time and energy perceiving what you can simply remember? However, the furniture and other contents of your bedroom are not truly what you perceive when you first wake up. You are already familiar with the place where you sleep and what it contains. There is no reason to continue to effortfully and consciously apprehend what you already understand. Instead, you are liable to perceive your surroundings psychologically. You begin to consider how you are going to conduct yourself on the stage you will inevitably occupy and what is going to happen in consequence. What you see upon waking is an array of possibilities, many of them concerning the day at hand and others associated with the weeks, months, and years to come. What you are truly concerned with upon waking is the answer to a question. What shall I make of the possibilities that I see in play in front of me? Complex, worrisome, exciting, dull, restricted, unlimited, fortunate, or catastrophic as they may be. Out there in the potential is everything you could have. It is the realm of unrealized possibility, and no one knows its full extent. There appears to be no limit, in principle, to what can be made from what has not yet manifested itself. Everything that might yet be makes its home there. You could well consider what remains to be encountered as an eternal treasure house or horn of plenty, which are in fact two of its representations. But that would be only half the story, and there is the rub. If the potential you confront manifests itself improperly because of a mistake on your part, because of the sheer arbitrariness of the world, then you can find yourself in terrible trouble. Out there in the unknown, in the future, which is what you truly contend with when your consciousness reawakens, awaits everything good, but also everything terrible, painful, hellish, and deadly. Whatever potential might be, therefore, it does not follow the simple rules of material logic. Objects that play by the rules of the game we consider real, when we assume that what is real is also logical, can only be one thing at a time, and certainly not themselves and their opposite, simultaneously. Potential, however, is not like that. It is not categorizable in that manner. It is tragedy, comedy, good and evil, and everything in between at the same time. It is also not tangible in the sense that the things we consider real must be tangible. It does not even exist, except as what could be exists. Perhaps it is best considered as the structure of reality, before reality manifests itself concretely in the present, where reality appears to most self-evidently exist. But creatures such as us do not contend with the present. It may therefore be that it is not the present that is most real, at least as far as our consciousness is concerned. We have to fight to be here now, the advice of the sages. Left to our own devices, we turn our minds instead to investigating the future. What could be? Attempting to answer that question, that is life. That is the true encounter with reality. What is? That is the dead past already accomplished. What could be? That is the emergence of new being, new adventure, brought about by the conjunction of living consciousness with the great expanse of paradoxical possibility. And if it is possibility that is most real rather than actuality, as evidenced by the fact that it is possibility we are destined to contend with, then it is the investigation into possibility that is the most important of all investigations. But how do we investigate something that is not here or there or anywhere? How do we examine what has not yet manifested itself, explore what only could be, but is not yet? And how can we possibly communicate with each other intelligibly about that attempt? Trade information about the most effective conceptualizations, approaches, and strategies. The answer to that, as far as I can tell, is by communicating through stories about what is, and more importantly, what could be. And what that implies is that if possibility is the ultimate element of reality with which we contend, then it is stories that hold the wisdom that we most need to know. We naturally think of our lives as stories and communicate about our experience in that same manner. We tell people automatically where we are, to set the stage, and where we are going, so that we can create the present out of the possibility that springs forth as we journey toward our destination. No one finds such an account out of the ordinary. But we are doing more than portraying our lives and those of others as a sequence of events. It is something deeper than that. When you depict a person's actions in the world, you describe how they perceive, evaluate, think, and act. And when you do so, a story unfolds, and the better you are at such descriptions, the more story-like your accounts are. Furthermore, we experience the world as populated by figures that represent exactly what we must contend with. The unknown, unexpected, and novel, the world of possibility, is represented in dramatic form, as is the world that we desire and strive to bring into being. The same holds true of ourselves, as actors faced with the unknown and the predictable alike. We use the story to represent all of this. Could it be that we communicate in stories, and everyone else understands them, because what everyone is doing in the world is fundamentally a story? Could that mean that the world of experience is, in truth, indistinguishable from a story, that it cannot be represented in a manner more accurate than that of the story? We are, in principle, adapted to the world, adapted to its realities. Thus, if we naturally construe the world as a story, then perhaps the world is most accurately, or at least most practically, construed as a story, and accurate and practical are not so easy to distinguish. You might argue, contrarily, that the scientific view of the world is more accurate in some sense, and that the scientific view is not fundamentally a story. But as far as I can tell, it is still nested inside a story, one that goes something like, careful and unbiased pursuit of the truth will make the world a better place for all people, reducing suffering, extending life, and producing wealth. Why practice science otherwise? Why would anyone take on the difficulties and rigors of scientific training without that motivation? There are more effective ways of making money, for example, if you have the intelligence and discipline necessary to become a genuine researcher. And, in terms of intrinsic motivation, the love of science is not precisely disinterested learning. The great experimenters and scientific writers I have known are passionate about their pursuit. Something emotional drives them. They hope that their learning, disinterested though it may be, as at present it has no specific aim except that of learning, will have some genuinely positive outcome, making the world a better place. That provides the entire pursuit with a narrative element, the motive that accompanies any good plot and the transformation of character that makes up the best of stories. We conceptualize what we experience as a story. That story is, roughly speaking, the description of the place we are at right now, as well as the place that we are going to, the strategies and adventures that we implement and experience along the way, and our downfalls and reconstitutions during that journey. You perceive and act inside a structure like that all the time, because you are always somewhere, going somewhere else, and you are always evaluating where you are and what is going on in relation to your goal. Part of this thinking in stories is our tendency to see the world as a selection of characters, each of which represents where we are or are going, the unexpected occurrences we may encounter, or ourselves as actors. We see animated intent everywhere, and we certainly present the world that way to our children. That is why Thomas the Tank Engine has a face and a smile, and the sun has a face and a smile. That is why, even among adults, there is a man in the moon and deities scattered across the stars. Everything is animated. That is a reflection of our proclivity to treat things as if they are personalities with intent, regardless of what they are, regardless of whether they are animate or inanimate. That is why it is okay with you that your car has a face on the front where faces belong, which it most certainly does. We act, perceive, think, react that way because each member of the human species does almost everything he or she does in the presence, for better or worse, of other people. And that has been the case forever. Virtually everything we encountered in the long biological rise to our current form was social. If we were not interacting with people, then it was with animals. Maybe we were hunting them, or herding them, or playing with them once they had been domesticated. Or maybe they were hunting us, and we had to understand them to escape them or defend ourselves. All that tribal, intertribal, and cross-species interaction molded our brains, shaped our fundamental categories, rendering them social, not objective, not like the categories of science. It is not as if we are born with an instinct for the periodic table of the elements. No. We only managed to get that straight a few hundred years ago, and it took a lot of conscious time and effort to formulate. Furthermore, even though it was other people who did the terribly hard work necessary to establish that remarkable chemical category system, it is difficult to learn. It is not that interesting, intrinsically, at least for most people, because there is no story associated with it. It is an accurate and useful representation of the objective reality of what is, beyond the shadow of a doubt, but it is a struggle to master perception of that abstracted sort. Conversely, if someone is telling you a story, it attracts your attention immediately. It can be a complicated and cognitively difficult story, something requiring hours of concentration. It might even be the story of how the periodic table of the elements was discovered, and the triumphs and difficulties that accompanied the process. It does not matter. If it is well told, it is gripping and likely to be remembered. If you want to teach children something and get them to attend, tell them a story. They will repeatedly ask you to do that. They do not grab your pant leg and beg, "Dad, one more line from the periodic table of the elements before bed." But they are highly motivated to hear a story, sometimes even the same one every night. That is an indication of the depth and importance of stories. You might think the repeated story is simple, but your child listening intently, is processing the multiple levels of meaning represented in any decent tale, meanings of which you are very unlikely to be aware if the story you are telling is traditional and deep.
We are all human. That means there is something about our experience that is the same. Otherwise, we would not all be human. We would not even be able to communicate. To communicate, paradoxically, there must be things about you and others that can go without saying. Imagine telling someone, "I got really angry this morning." If there is any indication you want the conversation to continue and they are agreeable, they might ask you why. But they are not likely to ask you, "What do you mean, angry?" They do not ask the latter question because they already know, from their own experience, what angry means. It can be assumed rather than explained. In fact, the only reason you can talk about anything at all is because there are some things you do not have to ever talk about. You can just take them for granted. We know worldwide, for example, that there are basic sets of emotions shared by all humans and by many animals. Everyone understands a growling mother bear standing in front of her cubs, teeth bared for all to see. It is those things that you do not have to talk about that most precisely make us human, that constitute the essence, mutable though it remains through the actions of society and environment. So, on to the story. To the story of the story, in fact. We will begin by meeting the characters whose existence universally structures our understanding of the potential of the world. And, with luck, as you meet them, you will begin to understand their relationship to resentment, arrogance, and deceit well enough so that understanding will offer you some protection. The eternal characters of the human drama. The Dragon of Chaos. When my son Julian was about 4 years old, he watched the movie Pinocchio obsessively, particularly the sequence that portrays the whale, Monstro, transforming into a fire-breathing dragon. He must have seen it 50 times. And it was not obvious that he enjoyed it. He was clearly afraid of the climactic scene. I could see it on his face. He had good reason for his fear. The characters he had come to identify with had laid it all on the line. There was a strong motif of danger and sacrifice. Nonetheless, it was the scene that fascinated him the most. What in the world was he doing watching the film repeatedly? Particularly if the emotion it produced was fear. Why would a child voluntarily subject himself to that? Julian was using all the faculties of his newly forming mind, rational and unconscious alike, to process the relationships in such a tale. Pinocchio and stories like it are dense, layered, and complex in ways that seize the imagination of children and will not let go. That is not accidental. Kids are small and young, and in some ways, they do not know anything because they have very little personal experience. But they are also very ancient creatures in another manner and by no means stupid or inattentive. The fact that they are gripped by fairy tales and stories like Pinocchio is an indication of just how much depth children perceive in those stories, even if you, as an adult observer, do not notice it anymore. Pinocchio's whale is the Dragon of Chaos. This is the symbolic representation of potential, of possibility, for better and for worse. Representations of this figure appear everywhere, and children see them even if they have no idea what those figures mean. In another Disney classic, Sleeping Beauty, the evil queen, Maleficent, entraps Prince Philip. She chains him in her castle dungeon and tells him a charming fairy tale of sorts. She delights in describing to him the ruined and ancient man he will be 6 or 7 decades in the future when she deigns to release him from his cell. She portrays him as nothing but the parody of a hero and has a fine time doing so, locking the door to his prison cell on her departure, climbing the stairs back to her palace, laughing evilly all the while. She is the classic devouring Oedipal mother, preventing her son from manifesting his destiny by refusing to allow him to leave home. The prince escapes from the dungeon with the help of the positive feminine, 3 helpful fairies who are clearly the mythical counterparts to Maleficent. The evil queen sees him mount his horse and make his dangerous way through her army, across her crumbling, quickly closing drawbridges, and down the road leading outside the would-be death trap of her castle. With ever-increasing dismay, she leaps from turret to turret until she makes her way to the uppermost place. There she stands, enraged, calling up the fires of hell themselves, and transforms herself into a gigantic, fire-breathing dragon. Everyone viewing the movie accepts that as a given. Of course the evil queen turns into a dragon. There's no problem with that. Why exactly is that universally acceptable? On the face of it, the transformation makes no sense at all. One moment she is standing, a perfectly understandable, although exceedingly irritated evil queen. Next, she spins around a few times and poof, she's a gigantic fire-breathing reptile. Perhaps you are all thinking, as you listen to this, why are you making an issue of this? Even my 4-year-old understands that. I do not have a problem with an evil queen turning into a dragon. It is so self-evident that it can happen even in the middle of a popular movie and be accepted at face value. So self-evident that it is very difficult to draw people's attention to the idea that something very strange has happened. However, if Queen Elizabeth II suddenly turned into a giant, fire-breathing lizard in the midst of one of her endless galas, a certain amount of consternation would be both appropriate and expected. People, even monarchs of a great kingdom, do not just transform into dangerous reptiles and attack their guests. Well, not at most parties. But if it happens within the context of a story, then we accept it. That does not explain the mystery, however. Not just any old transformation can happen within a story. It would not have made any sense if Maleficent had donned a sparkly pink outfit and begun to cast roses on the pathway Prince Philip galloped down to escape his confinement. That was not in Maleficent's nature, nor in the set of narrative expectations that every audience implicitly brings to every movie, and is unlikely to appreciate having disrupted unless done with exceptional finesse and higher-order purpose. But it is no problem for her to become a dragon. Why? It is partly because nature can and constantly does revert from her dangerous but still understandable guise into total chaos. This happens, for example, when the campfire we just built to cook our hot dogs and sit around singing campfire songs catches a sudden gust of hot, dry air, and the long parched forest, hypothetically sheltering our tents, ignites into a raging inferno. Dangers we can handle can suddenly turn themselves into dangers we cannot handle. That is why it is no surprise to anyone when the evil queen becomes the dragon of chaos. Imagine, for a moment, that you are a prehistoric, proto-human being. You are camped for the night, and that site is defined territory, safety and predictability for the time being. Your friends are there, your tribal kin. You have your spears. You have your fire. It is safe, or at least what passes for safe under such conditions. But if you carelessly wander a mere 200 feet away from the campfire, then something horrible with teeth and scales eats you. That is what is out there in the terrible unknown. That idea is deeply embedded inside of us. We know that human beings are innately afraid of reptilian predators, for example. And there is good reason for that. It is not merely that we are prepared to learn fear of them, which we certainly are. The fear itself is innate. For all intents and purposes, there is an image that exists inside of us of the terrible hunter that lurks in the night. That is why children become afraid of the dark once they are old enough to move around by themselves. "There's a monster in the dark, Dad," they insist at nighttime, and Dad assures his son or daughter that there is no such thing as a monster. Well, the adult is wrong, and the child is exactly right. There might not be a monster in that particular section of the dark right now, but that is of small comfort when you are 3 feet high and tasty, and there could be, will be, a monster there in the future. That is why it might be of more use to let your child know directly and through your own actions that there is always something sinister and dangerous in the dark, and that it is the job of the well-prepared individual to confront it and take the treasure it archetypally guards. This is something that an adult and child can both act out with great results. About a year and a half before his encounter with Pinocchio, I took Julian to the Boston Science Museum. There was a Tyrannosaurus Rex skeleton there. It was impressively large, as far as I was concerned, but it was even larger from his perspective. He would not get closer than 100 feet. At 150 feet, his curiosity drove him forward. But things came to a stop when we got closer. That was a neurological phenomenon, too. His curiosity drove him forward toward the monster so he could collect some useful information. Until the fear froze him. I could see exactly where that boundary lay. Maybe it defined how far away he would need to be to remain safe if that thing suddenly whipped its head around to grab him. There is an idea embedded deep within the human psyche that potential can be a place of maximal horror, home to an infinite predator, or an infinite variety of predators. Practically speaking, this is true, as human beings have been prey animals since the beginning of time, although we made it very difficult for the predators once we effectively armed ourselves and banded together. Personally, I'm happy about that. I have camped where the grizzly bears were plentiful. It is nice that they're on the planet and all that, but I prefer my grizzlies shy, not too hungry, and far enough away to be picturesque. There are spiritual and psychological forces operating in a predatory manner that can destroy you, too, and they can present an even greater danger. The malevolence in the heart of people that makes them criminal falls into that category, as does the evil that drives the totalitarian war of revenge, rapine, greed, or sheer love of blood and destruction. And that malevolence also exists in your heart, and that is the greatest dragon of all, just as mastering that malevolence constitutes the greatest and unlikeliest of individual achievements. You are built neurologically to interpret the world in this dramatic manner at a very deep level. An ancient part of your brain known as the hypothalamus, a small region sitting atop the spinal cord, regulates many of the fundamental responses that find their expression in the conceptualization of danger and potential. The first of its two major modules is responsible for self-preservation, hunger, thirst, and most important for our purposes, defensive aggression in the face of threat, as well as reproduction, sexual arousal, and basic sexual behavior. The second major module is responsible for exploration. Half of the hypothalamus drives our use of what has been explored previously to quell and satisfy the basic demands of life, including our capability to protect ourselves in the case of attack. The other half is always asking, what is out there? What could it be used for? How might it be dangerous? What are its habits? So, what is the hypothalamic story? Eat, drink, and be merry until the provisions run out, but watch out always for the monsters. Then venture out into the dangerous but promising unknown world and discover what is there. Why? Well, you already know a lot of things you need to know, although you do not know nearly enough. You understand that because life is not as good as it could be, and because you are going to die. Obviously, under such conditions, you should learn more. So, you are driven to explore. The fundamental representation of reality as an eternal treasure house guarded by an eternal predator is therefore a perfect representation of the way you are wired to react to the world at the most fundamental depths of your being. Nature, creation and destruction. We all have an image of nature. It might be an image akin to a beautiful landscape, nature as benevolent and renewing. It is an image of that kind that grounds the sentimental environmentalist view of the world. Being from northern Alberta, I do not share exactly the same view of nature, since up in my hometown of Fairview, nature was constantly conspiring to freeze its inhabitants to death for 6 months of the year and to devour them with insects for at least two more. So that is the less romantic part of nature, which is red in tooth and claw. That is the part of nature associated with injury, disease, death, insanity, and everything else that can and will befall you as a biological creature on the negative end of the experiential continuum. There is the potential of the future that has not yet been transformed into reality, represented, as we have seen, by the Dragon of Chaos. But then there is the nature you encounter directly in your life, and which cannot be considered absolutely unknown. There is the benevolence of nature, the fact that you are here, alive, and sometimes happy, the fact that there is delicious food to eat and attractive, interesting people to interact with, and no shortage of fascinating things to see and do. There are amazing vistas of landscape. There is the beauty and immortality and immensity of the ocean. There is all the bountiful, wondrous element of natural being. But there is also the absolute horror that goes along with that: destruction, disease, suffering, and death. Those two elements of experience exist side by side. It is even the case that the former could not exist without the latter, even within your own body, healthy as it may be. A very delicate balance between the death of every cell that has outlasted its utility and the new life that springs forward to replace it is a prerequisite for your continued existence. Both these elements of existence manifest themselves in our imagination in personified form. One is the evil queen, the goddess of destruction and death. The other is her positive counterpart, the fairy godmother, the benevolent monarch, the young and loving mother watching with infinite care over her helpless charge. To live properly, you need to be acquainted with both these figures. If you are a child abused by your mother, familiar only with the evil queen, then you are damaged by the absence of love, stunted by lack of attention, and arbitrarily subject to fear and pain and aggression. That is no way to live. And it is very difficult to grow up functional and capable and void of distrust, hate, and the desire, say, for revenge. You need to find someone to act the part of the benevolent queen, a friend, a family member, a fictional character, or a part of your own psyche, motivated by knowing that your mistreatment is wrong, swearing to take any opportunity that comes your way to escape your misfortunate circumstances and balance your life appropriately. Maybe the first step in this direction is to posit, despite your mistreatment, that you are in fact worthy of care. And the second step is to give that care, where you can, despite receiving tragically little yourself. If you understand the polarity of nature, its terror and benevolence, you recognize two fundamental elements of experience: permanent, eternal, and unavoidable. And you can begin to understand, for example, the profound pull towards sacrifice. It is a religious trope that sacrifices keep the gods happy. And coming to understand just who the unhappy gods are, so to speak, and just how terrible they are when they are unhappy, is a genuine step toward wisdom, a genuine and humbling step. Modern people have a hard time understanding what sacrifice means because they think, for example, of a burnt offering on an altar, which is an archaic way of acting out the idea. But we have no problem at all when we conceptualize sacrifice psychologically, because we all know you must forego gratification in the present to keep the wolf from the door in the future. So, you offer something to the negative goddess so that the positive one shows up. You train long, difficult hours to be a nurse or a physician or a social worker. That sacrificial attitude is in fact the great discovery of the future, conjoined with the ability to negotiate and bargain and cope with that future. Abandon impulsive gratification. Let go of something you need and want. Obtain something valuable in the long run in consequence, and keep the horror at bay. You forego the partying and the easy hours. You immerse yourself instead in the difficulties of life. You do that so that fewer of those difficulties will manifest themselves for yourself, employed gainfully as you will become, and for all the others you will help, as the strength you develop through proper sacrifice makes itself manifest. We are always bargaining in that manner. We act out the belief that we can strike a bargain with the structure of reality. Strangely enough, we often can. If you are sensible, you do that all the time. You prepare for the worst. You prepare for the arrival of the evil queen. You do what you have to do, knowing about her existence, and you keep her at bay in proportion to your wisdom and in accordance with your luck. And, if you succeed, benevolent nature smiles upon you, until she does not. But at least you have some control over the situation. You are not a sitting duck or a babe in the woods or a rube at the amusement park, or at least no more so than you have to be. Nature is chaos, furthermore, because it is always wreaking havoc with culture, its existential opposite, and the next subject of our investigation. After all, as Robert Burns has it, the best laid schemes of mice and men gang aff de glay. And it is often nature, in positive and negative guise, that does precisely that. It is no easy matter to balance the fragility of life and the necessity for procreation, and all the uncertainty of pregnancy and birth and child-rearing, with the desire for certainty, predictability, and order. And this is to say nothing of death. And even cancer is, after all, just another form of life. But all that is not to say, ever, that chaos is of less value than order. There is nothing but sterility without unpredictability, even though a bit less unpredictability often seems desirable.